Rewind series, recalling the past 40 years ago. If we consider the exhausting length of today's presidential campaign, which has been going on now for over a year, it seems almost impossible that a campaign could capture the imagination of an entire country in just over 2 months. Yet that's exactly what happened in 1968. Robert F. Kennedy, affectionately known to all as Bobby Kennedy, against the advice of his brother Senator Ted Kennedy and many of the leading Democratic Party leaders, entered the presidential race on March 16, 1968. Pacifica Radio was there to record his meteoric rise from latecomer to his assassination in the early morning hours of June 4, 1968, following his victory in the final and most coveted primary of the race, California. We begin by hearing one of Bobby Kennedy's early speeches of his campaign in late March 1968 on the campus of San Fernando State Valley College, later named Cal State Northridge. He begins by playfully taking a jab at Richard Nixon, who Kennedy believed would be his opponent in the 1968 presidential election.
I'm very impressed that there are still three people for Richard Nixon. And then there's a sign over here about a carpetbagger, and he's obviously against Richard Nixon. But I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very grateful for the warm response. I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and Governor Maddox said that he'd rather have Fidel Castro for president. But I thought that I was making progress. I thought that my campaign has been moving steadily along. Especially yesterday when George Hamilton called me and asked me for my daughter's telephone number. And I thought that I had a bright future, and then when I came back from my speech at the University of Kansas about Vietnam, a reporter came to me and asked me if I would take the vice presidency under Lyndon Johnson. And I said, evidently, they didn't understand my remarks. I thought that a coalition government was possible in Saigon, but not even. Well, we're getting better organized. And before I came out here, knowing I was coming here, I asked my younger brother if he would put together some campaign buttons. And he brought 10,000 campaign buttons down to put on the plane to take out here to California. And I opened them up and I found they all had his picture on them. And I told him I thought it was a little late for him to get in the race. And the people would think he was ruthless. But I am very pleased to be here. I'm going to speak to you for a few minutes, and then I'd be glad to answer questions for a little while. And if you have some easy ones, if you could think them up. Lord Chesterfield once said that the young leading the young is like the blind leading the blind. They will both fall into the ditch. Lord Chesterfield, fortunately, was not a member of the California legislature. And he didn't visit New Hampshire in March. It's probably for the better that Lord Chesterfield is not alive today, for you would see young people leading rebellions and upheavals which strike at the core of the authority of this country and countries all over the world, so filled with their own power that they even make photographers leave stands. Students at universities, that has been not accomplished by any political figure anywhere in the world, anytime. Students at universities demand the right to free speech and assembly. They demand a voice, of course, in the way of their own education. The government urges order. It appeals to their patriotism. It points to the threat of foreign forces. It calls for unity from within. But the students do not listen. They boycott classes and they stage sit-ins. I want to make it clear that I support these brave students. The students... the students of Warsaw, of Krakow, and Prague in their fight against communist tyranny in Eastern Europe. You sort of missed the... You see, you all got worked up about it. I thought you thought I was talking about you, and I wasn't. Shall I run through that paragraph again? I want to make it clear that I support these brave students, the students of Warsaw... The rest is a little easier. What the students of Poland now fight for, and what the students of Czechoslovakia have won, is not a victory of ideology, but a victory of spirit. It is this spirit which has been heard in the courtrooms of Moscow, in the streets of Spain, and in the schools of California. And that is the spirit of youth. The youthfulness that I speak of is not a time of life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of imagination, a predominance of courage over timidity, of the appetite for adventure over a life of ease. It is a spirit which knows the difference between force and reason. It does not accept the failures of today as a reason for the failures of tomorrow. It knows that we can clasp the future and that we can hold it to our will. And this is the spirit. This is the spirit that I want to see return to the United States of America, and it's why I run for President of the United States. For we are the heirs of a revolution which was born with the spirit of youth, the conviction that the mind of man must be free to think and to act, the kind that has kindled the worldwide fires which still burn today. Everywhere I have traveled in the world, in great capitals, in tiny villages, I have found men looking to our principles, often to the very words of our history, to find the inspiration for their own struggles for freedom. The strength of the spirit survives, even today, in the lands of tyranny. Not long ago, a poet, jailed and beaten for staging an illegal demonstration, demanded his right to criticize, pointing to the example of the United States Constitution and the United States of America. But this poet was a Russian, and his trial was in Moscow, and his words were smuggled out to the West by a grandson of a great Bolshevik hero. A young Russian writer, Yuri Galanzov, defied the tribunal which convicted his colleagues, saying, and I quote, "So far there is still slavery, but at least there is a movement afoot to defend freedom and justice." The young men of Eastern Europe and of the Soviet Union have risked their careers and their liberty to defend the rights of their friends and of their colleagues. And they have found their strength in the words of our heritage. How ironic that it is at the very time here in the United States that our own example spreads the seeds of liberty abroad, and yet here at the same time, here at home, we point to the danger of the fullest exercise of that liberty. At least some of us do. There are those who decry the growth of dissent. They urge that and I quote, that the time has come to unite, to support our leaders, to support our government. And they ask, which side are you on? I got somebody listening. And I think the time has come to answer that question. I think you are. on the side of those who seek to preserve a decent respect for the opinion of mankind, retaining the common sense of purpose that was always our bond in the past. I am on the side, and I believe you are, on those who are not afraid to recognize past error, as I must recognize it in my own actions in dealing with the problem and struggle in South Vietnam. Who refuse to blindly pursue bankrupt policies which rend us from our friends and drain our treasury in the fruitless pursuit of illusions which have long since been shattered. I am on the side of those who seek to reconcile the divisions that exist within our country, divisions of age and divisions of belief, divisions that exist because of the color of our skin, who will respect differences in ideas while uniting us in the determination to meet our dilemmas, who will not watch frozen in the ice of their own indifference. I am on the side of those who seek to bring jobs into the dark corners of our nation, in city slums and in the rural hollows alike, where proud men seek work and receive instead a welfare handout, and I don't think that's satisfactory. I am with those who seek to build their communities instead of ignoring them out of apathy or destroying them out of despair. I'm on the side of those who seek more than blind dissent and who respect the opinion of others. I am with those who express not simply opposition to the present, but propositions for the building of a better country. And very importantly, I am on the side of those who do not shout down others, but who listen and challenge and then prepare a better policy for the United States of America. I am on the side of permitting others to speak, even those with whom I disagree. And I think that's what a university should stand for. I think that many of you oppose our present action in Vietnam as many college students across the United States do. But I think that it's fundamental in our system and what we learn at a university that we permit those who have a different point of view to come to a university campus and speak and give their views and give their ideas and give them respectful attention. I stand for that, and I hope you do too. I stand then with those who accept the spirit of youth, the conviction of possibility, and the hope for the future. I stand with that spirit, so evident in Senator McCarthy's gallant New Hampshire campaign, which reminds us we are the masters, not the subjects of our government. I stand with that spirit wherever it lives, in Warsaw, in Prague, in Rome, and in New York, in the halls of power in Moscow and Washington, in San Fernando, and at this university. And that's where I want the United States to stand for. For here is where the world is truly divided, not by the long dead barriers of race and religion, not by the boundaries of state and nation, not even by the walls of ideology. It is divided today. Ronald Reagan, I'll get even with you. My speech was so eloquent, I started hearing bells. It is divided today between those who are bound by the past and those freed for the future, between the world of memory and the world of hope, between the spirit of age and between the spirit of youth. I stand between and with the spirit of youth, and I believe that's where the America that we know should stand for, and it's why I run for president. And what I believe that means is a new effort, and a new effort with new leadership to end the conflict in Vietnam and to bring the journey back to peace. It will recognize with Sophocles that all men make mistakes, but that a good man yields when he knows his course is wrong, and then he repairs the error, and that the only sin is pride. A new leadership will not risk more and more lives, American and Vietnamese alike, in the name of false pride. As I have said before, that kind of leadership will put aside once and for all the false hopes of concentrating on just a military conquest, which hopes that we will, after we have spent $30 billion of dollars each year, and lately 500 American lives, to seek a military victory that we have always been promised and which we will never achieve. I think we should change our course of action. Instead, this new leadership will place its strength and its effort behind the task of building a peace of brave men, a peace which we must have now before there is nothing left of Vietnam. It will seek that peace by recognizing the steps that have never been taken by this administration and which I believe should be taken, but which will still hold the hope of a negotiated settlement. I think that we should hold out to our adversaries that we will negotiate with the National Liberation Front, our primary adversary in the struggle. I think we have to accept the fact, whether we like it or not, once we accept the fact that we do not unilaterally want to withdraw from South Vietnam, once we accept the fact that we're not going to be able to achieve just a military victory, I think that we have to accept the fact that the National Liberation Front or the Viet Cong is going to play some role in the future political process of South Vietnam. And I think that we have to end our search and destroy missions, which have cost so many American lives and so many lives of the South Vietnamese. Second, this new spirit will seek to bring a new kind of resource to the struggle for a better America, the energies and talents of individual American citizens. Too often we have, from the best of intentions, spent great resources and made great efforts, not only to find only at the end that our crises have worsened. We shall need new funds, but we shall also need better programs. Oh my God. The next one, they're coming to get me. But we need most of all leadership. Which will who'll arrange that? But we will need most of all leadership, which put the power to change in the hands of those who are willing to change. Leadership which will put the resources in control, not in remote offices, but in the towns and communities of America. These are the kinds of things that I think need to be done in the United States. And I think all of us have a role to play. I don't think it should be left just to Washington. I don't think it should be left just to those who are public officials in Washington. I think the problems are too great, and I think all of us have a great stake in the future. You more than anybody else. As President Kennedy once said, you have the least ties to the past and the greatest stake in the future. The decisions that we make at our level are going to have the greatest effect on all of you. That's why I think you should play an active role, whether you agree or disagree with me or any other political figure, to let your views be known, to take an active interest and an active role. That's what this country's about. That's what's going to change this country. Dante said that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in time of moral crisis, preserve their neutrality. What we are going to do in this year, what we're going to do in the year 1968, is going to determine the future of this country for decades and decades ahead. You have it's your interest, and you have the chance to change it. You have the chance to change it here in the all-important primary in the state of California, but you and students like you have the chance to change the course of that this country is following over the period of the last few years. You have the chance to change it over the period of the next decade. Not just by protesting, not just by walking around with signs, but becoming actively involved. Making your views known, but actively involving yourselves. Being involved in registration, being involved in voting, ensuring that everybody is going to go to the polls, to take an active role in the political process of this country. That's what's going to make a difference. That's how the course of this nation's going to be changed, and you've got to do it. And the problems that we have in our own country, I don't think that we have to accept the divisions that exist between races, that blacks and whites cannot get along together. I don't think we have to accept the violence and the lawlessness and the disorder. Members of the administration a few weeks ago promised that we can expect this kind of violence summer after summer. I don't think we have to accept that here in the United States of America. I think that we can do better. I think that we can ensure that a man that wants to work and lives in Watts has a job. I think we can ensure that a man who wants to get off welfare and find employment can raise his family and find a job. That's what I stand for. I think that the federal government should play a major role. I think the private sector should play a major role. I think we should give tax incentives to the private sector and bring them into the great areas of unemployment. I don't think that it's satisfactory in eastern Kentucky or in the Delta area of Mississippi that people are gradually starving to death. Here in the United States of America, with a gross national product of $800 billion. We spend $3 billion every year on pets. I think we can spend enough money to get enough food for children to not starve in Delta area Mississippi. That's why I'm running for president. I think that if we have enough ingenuity and enough imagination and enough intelligence to get to the moon, I think we can arrange it so that the men of eastern Kentucky can find jobs, that we can develop a system so they can find jobs. And I want to work with all of you in developing that kind of a system. I don't think that we can sit here, that we can stay here in the United States and feel that we can be an island of affluence surrounded by a sea of poverty. I think we have a responsibility and an obligation to our fellow members of mankind, not just in Southeast Asia, but in Latin America. For the average person that dies is under the age of 4. That's 7 out of 10 children in many of the villages of Northeast Brazil where I've been die before the age of 1. I don't think that's satisfactory. I don't think that we can live these kind of lives that we live here. You attending a university and me having a happy life in the Senate of the United States, less happy lately, but a happy life. I don't think that we can accept that kind of existence goes on around the rest of the world. And I think that we can do something about it here in the United States. And I think we have an obligation to try. And I think that we are a country of idealism. We are a country of compassion. We are a country that feels about these issues. And I don't think that we should concentrate on the worst sides of us. I think that if we know what needs to be done, that we here in the United States, not just on our university campuses, but we here in the United States will do something about it. To feel the giant agony of the world, someone once wrote, to feel the giant agony of the world and more like slaves to poor humanity, labor for mortal good, I think that's what we should apply ourselves to. I think that that's what we should dedicate ourselves to. You here at the university and those of us in public life, and that's why I'm running for President of the United States. Thank you very much.
Bobby Kennedy from the campus of Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles, late March 1968. After his speech, he fielded a handful of questions. One person brought up the concern of Ted Kennedy and the other Democratic Party leaders that Bobby's entrance into the race would split the vote of the Democratic Party and hurt the Democrats' chances of defeating the Republican nominee in November.
The question is, once I get the nomination, did you say if or once?
When?
When I get the nomination, will I fear that I have split the Democratic Party so divisively that we can't win? There are two things that I'd say to that. First, it split before I went into the campaign. I think that was obvious from the state of New Hampshire. Secondly, I'm going to count on winning because I'm going to be running against Richard Nixon. And let me say third, I think that there's a new power existing in the United States that goes beyond politicians. It goes beyond political figures. I don't think those decisions are going to be made anymore by political figures or politicians. I think they're going to be made by you and people like you all over the country. Not just the young, but people who are going to take an active interest in the future of this country. And I think with their help that I can win the election in November.
Many thought that Bobby Kennedy's support of Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, and the United Farm Workers in their Delano grape strike would hurt his chances of winning the California primary, a concern that Bobby would prove wrong. Here Bobby Kennedy states his position on the farm workers' struggle.
First, I have sponsored legislation in the Senate of the United States to permit farm workers to organize and be represented, and that the farmers should recognize them. That's an important first step, and a very, very important step in southeast part of the United States, as well as here in the state of California. I'm a member of the subcommittee on migrant labor, and I think that we've done a great deal as far as health, as far as education programs, health programs, education programs, and training programs. I don't think nearly enough is being done. There are 100,000 migrant workers at the present time in the United States with incomes less than $1,000 a year. I think that there's much more that needs to be done. I've associated myself with Cesar Chavez because I think that's important that steps be taken, and I will continue to do so if I'm elected President of the United States.
The question that may have been most difficult for Bobby to answer was whether he would, as president, open the National Archives, which contain the sealed classified information on the assassination of his brother, President John F. Kennedy.
I'm sure, as it's been said before, the archives will be open. I think that, could I just say that, and I haven't answered this question before, but there would be nobody that would be more interested in all of these matters as to who was responsible for the death of President Kennedy than I would. I have seen all of the matters in the archives. If I became President of the United States, I would not reopen the Warren Commission report. I think I stand by the Warren Commission report. I've seen everything in the archives. The archives will be available at the appropriate time.
By 1968, the United States' involvement in Vietnam was increasingly unpopular, not just because of the resulting cost in lives, money, and resources, but because it was thought of as an immoral war, a war we had no business being involved in. Consider that on January 31st, just weeks prior to this recording, the North Vietnamese waged the Vietnam Tet Offensive, which resulted in record casualties on both sides of the war. Bobby Kennedy addresses these concerns in answering the next question.
Yeah, well, the question was, will I fight for a rapid de-escalation of our military and political interference with other countries around the rest of the world? I think that it's easy to say yes to that, but I think that the situation and the problem is far, far more complicated. As I said earlier, I think that we have a responsibility to other countries in the world. I think what has impressed me most as I've traveled to Africa and to Asia and to Latin America is the role that the Peace Corps has played. Now, you might say that's interference in the affairs of other people, but it's helping other people. I think the food for peace that we sent down to Latin America increased the number of children going to school by 35% because it's their only chance of their only opportunity to obtain a meal. So they went to school and they increased their education. I'm in favor of those kind of programs. I'm not in favor of, because we have a system here which we are satisfied with. I'm not in favor, which I think is perhaps the gist of your question, I'm not in favor of us attempting to subject another nation, another government, to our political control and say that in order to get any help from us, they have to accept our way of life.
You are listening to the voice of Bobby Kennedy on From the Vault, the original weekly series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For more information, go to fromthevaultradio.org.
And you're listening to this special here on 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. More Bobby Kennedy in just a moment.
A few weeks later, Bobby Kennedy was back in Los Angeles to speak in front of a gathering of business and financial leaders at the Biltmore Hotel on April 19, 1968. Again, we'll hear Kennedy's charm even when facing a hostile demographic.
I'm pleased to have an opportunity to talk to all of you, business community, financial community, where I have such wide support. They took a poll, one of the financial magazines, amongst 500 businessmen, of the man they admired the most and who they'd like to see president. And I got one vote. So. And I understand they're looking for him. So. So I gather this is not a Democratic rally on my behalf. But I'm pleased to be here. I come here to propose a new fusion between the genius of our private technology and the resources of our public authority to build an America where the citizen is not enslaved by technical achievement, but freed by it, where this resource is put to work not simply in improving the quantity of our goods, but to improve the quality of our lives. We have already seen here in California what the growth of technology can bring, what it can do for us, and what it can do to us. It is here that the genius of science is building motors to power a rocket to the moon. And it is here that some of the beaches have become so polluted that many cannot be used for swimming. It is here that planes are being built to fly men across the oceans in 2.5 hours. And it is here that neglect of public transit has trapped the young job seeker, Watts, 2 hours away from a decent job. It is here that the fruits of affluence have brought the automobile to millions of citizens. And it is here 60 years after the big red car took 30 minutes from city to beach that a motorist, if he is lucky, can make the same journey in 40 minutes. It is here that an expanding economy has given leisure so that men might enjoy their lives. And it is also here that we can see overcrowding and traffic congestion in the midst of the Yosemite National Park. It is here that students at Caltech, at UCLA, and other schools study at the console of a modern computer, absorbing skills and learning with awesome speed. And it is also here that the students in the ghettos of Los Angeles, trapped by irrelevant and inadequate schools, fall years behind the national reading average. These contrasts are not just California's. They are all across the face of our land. The benefits we reap from technology tell us how much can be done. The darker consequences tell us how much there is to do.
The death of Robert F. Kennedy marked yet another tragic milestone in one of the most turbulent and tumultuous years in United States history. There was an unrest in this country and around the globe that was articulated in this recent interview with USA Radio Network's White House correspondent, Connie Lawn, who was a young journalist getting her first major work covering the presidential campaign with Robert F. Kennedy. She spoke with BBC journalist Joanne Griffith about her experience on the campaign trail with Kennedy and the relevance of the historic events of 1968 in today's landscape. Woven into this interview, as she describes the evening of Bobby Kennedy's shooting, is actuality from this event recorded and broadcast by KPFK Radio in Los Angeles and preserved in the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Just kind of take us back to the beginning of the whole election campaign with Bobby Kennedy. I mean, what was it like and how is it compared with other election campaigns that you've covered since 1968?
Oh, Joanne, it was the most amazing experience. First of all, many of us started out following Eugene McCarthy, and I joined his campaign as a reporter. Well, first a volunteer, and then I became a reporter up in the snowy cold of New Hampshire. And we stuck with McCarthy through New Hampshire up until Indiana through a couple of the primaries. Really cold, slept on church benches and in broom closets. And then as McCarthy was slipping and Robert Kennedy got into the campaign, at this time, Lyndon Johnson announced he was not going to run again for president, and the Vietnam War was going very badly. Many of us thought that Robert Kennedy would be a much more viable, dynamic candidate than Eugene McCarthy, and we switched to his campaign. It was a better campaign to cover. And he was the most remarkable man. The Kennedys know how to get along well with the press. I suppose you could say they know how to co-opt the press. You know, we had a lot of access to them. We had the touch football games. We became part of their extended Kennedy family. I know you can say it's not good for reporters to be that way, but that's the truth of how it happened. And even people who hated the Kennedys, and there weren't too many on the campaign who did, as time went by, became to admire them and frankly supported them as president. Just as you've got the phenomenon today, you've got two things happening today. You have the boys on the bus, the Straight Talk Express with John McCain, who like John McCain because he's always been so good to the press and so open. And then you have the phenomenon of Barack Obama, where frankly more reporters are pro-Obama in this country than they are Hillary Clinton or John McCain. And the candidates know it, and they're very rankled by it. But reporters are also human, and reporters do have people they admire.
The Kennedys really understood how the media worked and how the media could be used to their benefit. But for you, as an independent, as a young reporter, right, then as well, you'd been covering. I mean, we've spoken to you about the assassination of Martin Luther King as well, and all those other stories that you covered during the historic year of 1968. But what was it like competing against your network colleagues, as it were, trying to get airtime with Bobby Kennedy?
That was rough. First of all, I was one of the few women on the bus or on the plane, and the men were always grabbing for me and trying to get me to spend the night in their hotel rooms, which I wasn't about to do. I mean, the men were very lonely, and the fact that I was the only woman running around with this pink miniskirt, in those days, men felt women were just playthings, and they didn't take us seriously. So you had that problem. You had the problem that I was young and a freelancer. I'd only been a reporter for about a year. I had no press credentials whatsoever until I was able to get press credentials from the Bob Kennedy campaign. They were my first ones, and that was quite amazing. And then, as time went by, Fred Dutton, one of the Kennedy insiders, gave me a Kennedy PT boat, which was the symbol of John Kennedy, PT-109. It also meant that you were respected as an insider. But there were periodic attempts by some of the staff members to kick me off the bus. They didn't realize how hard I was working. I did pay my bills. And don't forget, a reporter pays 1.5 times first-class airfare to travel with any candidate, not just the president. So I was filing to 13 different outlets, mostly around the world, whereas when my other colleagues finished the very arduous running around with the candidate and then filing their stories, they were able to go off to a bar and drink and relax and eat or get to sleep. I had to stay up almost all night filing. So it was very, very hard work. Only young people could do it. But it was worthwhile. As time went by, I developed a relationship with a man named Tony Sylvester, who was an anchor for the local CBS outlet here in Washington, D.C., which was WUSA, I believe, at the time, or WTOP. Anyway, Tony Sylvester very wisely said, Connie, see if you can get Bobby to come on our show every night right after a campaign victory. And we did that, which was amazing. It was an amazing scoop. You know, I got the senator, by the way, we all called him Bobby. I got him to the telephone, and he did about a two-minute interview with Tony Sylvester here in Washington. As a result, the night that Bobby Kennedy was shot, we were up in his hotel room in the Ambassador's Hotel. And even though it was 3 in the morning in the East, stations were broadcasting all night because it was the last primary. And so we got him on the phone, so we did that final interview with Tony Sylvester. We went down the elevator, and we were standing on the podium, and that's when Bobby made that speech. And now on to Chicago, on to victory, on to the presidency, and then he was shot.
This moment that tragedy struck the Kennedy family once again, just describe what it was like for all the reporters that were there. Obviously, you said that all of you had really struck up a rapport, not just with Bobby Kennedy, but with his wife as well, his wife,
right.
Ethel.
Great lady.
And you all effectively were friends in many senses. But just talk me through what you were doing the moment that he was shot.
Well, Joanne, it was absolutely gruesome. There were so many things that happened. First of all, many of us had actually seen Sirhan earlier, because when we were mingling, we were relegated to a press room. We were always stuck in a press room someplace. And our press room was in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, right behind the podium.
And, so, and just to clarify, Sirhan was Bobby Kennedy's assassinator.
Right, he's still in jail. He's still alive today. So some of us talked to him, but you know, at a campaign, you've got so many hangers-on from all walks of society that nobody is stranger than anybody else. At some point, as I told you, I had gone up to the senator's room, then I'd come down the elevator with him, and I was on the podium with him when he was shot. There seemed to be some quick glance of recognition on the senator's face, those of us who were close enough to him, saying, "It's finally come," because the Kennedys always knew they were in danger of assassination, and of course John Kennedy had been assassinated, Martin Luther King had been killed by this time, the Pope had also been shot but survived, thank God, so it was a brutal year. Anyway, Kennedy was picked up bleeding profusely from the head and everything else, and mostly the head, and he was laid out on the floor in the kitchen area behind the podium, and it was very, very hot. It was over 100 degrees. Ethel Kennedy, God bless her, she's like a lioness protecting her mate, and very, very pregnant at this time. And at one point, she looked up at the cameraman and the lighting men and said, "For God's sakes, turn off the lights, turn off the lights, let him breathe." And one of the cameramen looked down at her and said, "Sorry, lady, this is history." And they kept rolling.
I assume the people here are people who care. If you care, you are breathing in a hot room. Get out of this room. If somebody is hurt, give him the air. Get out of here.
Look, at that time, I think the poor senator was brain dead, but he was not declared dead for another 3 days. Now, at another point, there was this commotion going on, and Rosie Grier, the big, burly, black ex-football player who was really the bodyguard for all of us, incredible man, he had cornered Sirhan, who's a very little guy, threw him onto one of these metal kitchen tables and was sitting on him, just crushing him. And George Plimpton, the writer and whatever he is, bon vivant, who recently died, I believe, George Plimpton grabbed Sirhan's head and was very methodically banging it on the table, banging, and he just wanted to kill him, and none of us wanted to stop him. But then George's wife, Freddie, said, "Don't, George, don't, he's sick, he's sick." And that's the only thing, for better or for worse, that stopped Sirhan from being killed at that point. Ironically, his head would have been split open, as was the senator's. And then one more anecdote. At some point, I retrieved the phone, called, spoke to Alan, hung up, got a call through to Washington, did a live broadcast to Washington, and then realized I'm going to have to get into an ambulance because, again, I was a freelancer. I had nobody helping me out with transportation. So I ran downstairs, and the ambulances were being loaded. Senator Kennedy was put in this first ambulance, and Ethel, I assume. And then Pierre Salinger, the former press secretary, and his French wife just commandeered a motorcycle and followed that ambulance to Central Receiving Hospital. And then I just climbed into a third ambulance. By this time, I was covered with blood anyway. I guess the senator's blood. And then I was holding on to this man who had been shot in the stomach. So by the time we got to Central Receiving Hospital, we were both admitted. But, of course, I wasn't wounded. So I just got up and ran around and witnessed some horrible, horrible scenes with Ethel Kennedy fighting to be with her husband. I mean, it was just heartbreaking. And I grabbed a payphone and made another broadcast. Then at some point, I mean, I was the only unwounded reporter running around at free will inside the Good Samaritan Hospital. Central Receiving Hospital. And then at some point, the decision was made to load him up again and take him up the hill to this Catholic hospital that was Good Samaritan. And again, at that point, I do believe he was dead, but he was not declared for another 2 days. And so I had to run up the hill, and then I was standing outside on the grass with the rest of the reporters. And basically, for the next 3 days and three nights, broadcast almost every 20 minutes to Washington, at that time WAVA, which was the new all-news radio station, until we were told the senator was dead, and then had to make the very sad journey back to Washington, D.C.
Just to scroll back, you mentioned that Bobby Kennedy probably knew that this was coming.
Yeah.
What was security actually like? Because bearing in mind that this had happened to John F. Kennedy just a number of years previously, to Martin Luther King just a couple of months beforehand in April 68,
right.
What was the security like? Was there security? You know, could this have been prevented?
Yes, Joanne, it could have been, and that's an excellent question. You did not have metal detectors in those days. I have no memory of any Secret Service men provided by the government. I assume they had been around, but I've got no memory of it. Rosie Grier and some other ex-football players provided the senator's security. But there was no real security. I mean, so many of these rallies that we attended when the senator spoke all over the country, he was a rock star. And the crowds were massive, and they'd surge forward, and many times we were all squeezed against a fence until the fence gave way and broke, and then we all had to run like crazy to the plane or to the bus. It was very, very frightening. In fact, the signal that the senator gave to us that it was time to beat the crowd and run to the bus was his quote, as George Bernard Shaw once said, "Some people see things and ask why, others see dreams and ask why not," or something to that effect. But as soon as he said, as George Bernard Shaw once said, we knew to run or else we were going to get crushed by the crowds. Whenever there was a loud noise, the senator would duck, frankly. I had seen him duck behind the podium a few times. I saw him once fall to the floor and duck in the airplane because there was a loud noise or a backfire in the airplane. He was very frightened. This was such a nervous man. I have an episode earlier in the book when I talk about him at one of the campaign stops in Indiana, Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he got up there to speak, and there was no podium. And this is a man who shook very hard when he spoke. I mean, he was not a good public speaker, and he was not good with crowds. He was scared to death. So he'd shake all the time. So he got up there, and this was, I think, Concordia College, and said, "Where's the podium? I can't speak without a podium. I've got to have a podium." And we reporters scurried around till we could get him a podium. He just needed to have something between his body and the crowds. But even then, many times I sat at his feet because I had my tape recorder just kind of taped to the podium. We didn't have malt boxes every place you went. And he shook so hard, his feet were shaking so hard, that it nearly knocked my tape recorder off the stage. It was a tremendous effort for him to even attempt to become politician, become an elected politician. He was a behind-the-scenes planner. That's what he did for his brother John Kennedy. He never meant to run for office on his own.
And that's my other question, actually. For someone who was so nervous, someone who was a real background person, why did he decide to run?
The Kennedy legacy. Just as when Joe Kennedy was killed in World War II, Then the mantle fell to John Kennedy if he survived the war, which he did, barely, with a lot of wounds and a lot of pain. But it was then up to John Kennedy to become the first Catholic president of the United States. Joe Kennedy, the father, very ambitious, and that was his goal for all of his sons. And then when John died, it was Bobby, and after Bobby, it was Ted. And, of course, Ted might have been on his way if he hadn't had that accident at Chappaquiddick where the lady in his car, Mary Jo Kopechne, drowned.
Let's return to the death of Bobby Kennedy. And, of course, you mentioned before that once it was announced that he died, all the reporters were there and having to file the reports. I'm always very interested in what it's like for a reporter or anyone who has witnessed such a gruesome act against humanity and against an individual. Once you'd finished, what impact did it have on you and indeed your other journalist colleagues?
Well, I still have an impact. I mean, I have been very nervous about Barack Obama even before Hillary Clinton made those stupid statements. I think Barack Obama is a magnificent politician and has a lot of the passion and fire and eloquence that John Kennedy had. But the prospect of, God forbid, violence against him is very real. That's part of the reality of this country. Politicians are in danger. Anybody in public life, movie stars, you see that in Los Angeles, they are in danger. So I've just always had those flashbacks. By the time we knew that Bobby Kennedy had died, by the time it was formally announced, we knew. I think most of us really thought he was dead from the first few hours. He had to have been brain dead. If he had survived, he would have survived really with almost no human functions, and that would have been a greater tragedy.
You mentioned before your trusty tape recorder kind of sitting at the feet of Bobby Kennedy as he was giving his many speeches. It was also your trusty tape recorder that, recorded something perhaps that it shouldn't have done.
We were on the train, the Wabash Cannonball, one of the famous trains going across Indiana, and some of the reporters wrote the song The Ruthless Robbie, and they sang and played the song for the senator. At the beginning of the song, you hear me say, "Hello, Senator, we wrote this for you. Have a seat, Senator. Make yourself comfortable." Then they start to and Kennedy says, "It's nice, though, of course, right?" And then they start to sing the song, which is very funny. And then halfway through it, somebody stops the television cameras and says, "We don't want any rolling here. We want this nice, friendly, private session. You don't have any sound there, do you?" And you hear the television cameraman say, no, we have no sound. And, of course, they did have sound. But they did have to stop. At this point, I was, don't forget, a Cub reporter. I'd only been reporting for about 6 months at that point. I was terrified to admit that I was recording. So I slipped the newspaper over my tape recorder and kept going. And at the end, you have the laughter, and you have Kennedy saying, "As George Bernard Shaw once said," and we all laugh, and then he said, "Up yours, sideways." So it was very human. We had a lot of moments like that. That happens to be the only one I caught on tape.
It's wonderful, really, that you can look back on something so tragic with elements of humor and laughter. What happened to his wife, Ethel? Obviously, as you mentioned before, she was very heavily pregnant at the time. As you said, you know, she was a lioness trying to protect her husband, and there was that line of, well, you know, this is history, so we're just going to have to keep the cameras rolling. But again, it's always that human aspect. We have this very public political figure, but this was a man that had a family and friends. And what happened to her after all of this?
Well, she's amazing. Of course, they went through the beautiful funeral, the train ride, taking the body back from St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York back to Arlington National Cemetery. And she conducts herself with great dignity, as all the Kennedys do. Unfortunately, they're used to this. She went on to deliver a healthy baby. Most of her children are healthy. One died of a drug overdose. Some have become politicians. But the Kennedys are an amazing family. Now, I'm of the generation that was inspired by John Kennedy. I was in high school in those days, and like millions of people around the world, loved America and loved American politicians because of the idealism that John Kennedy brought to the White House in those days.
You've been listening to a documentary about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. His assassination took place 50 years ago next Monday. And this documentary comes to us from Pacifica. It is part of the Pacifica flash drive that we'll be offering during the next 7 days during our fundraising drive. 1,300 hours of programs from Pacifica on a tiny flash drive. And that you can listen back to programs like this. Other people featured on the flash drive, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NPR News. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. And in the next hour, we'll hear the Tom Hartman radio program live.